Hello and welcome to our Catholic News podcast. Now, our focus falls today on the Holy Land and particularly Gaza as we reflect on the 11-day war just in May 2021 that had such a devastating impact on the region and, of course, particularly the people of Gaza. Very much to talk about here today. Now, just weeks after a rather fragile ceasefire, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem, His Beatitude Pier Battista Pizzaballa, visited this small strip of Palestinian land from the 14th to the 17th of June. I'm delighted to say I'm joined by Sami El Youssef, the Chief Executive Officer of the Latin Patriarchate of Jerusalem, and of course, a member of that delegation. Sami, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
I was reading your reflection that you put out recently on the Patriarch's visit, and what I found particularly interesting is that you mentioned the emotional impact as potentially more disturbing than the physical damage. Can you just expand on that a bit for us?
Sure. I think what the people of Gaza went through was a continuous bombardment over a period of 11 days, which was 24/7, and it was quite intense. So people really are emotionally, I think, affected dramatically by the experience. And you can tell it by just, you know, listening to people, sitting down with them, and the mood swings that you see across all age groups, actually. You know, you're not talking about children. These are the most vulnerable, in a sense, that they don't understand what's going on, the dangers and so on. But you're talking about adults and even the elderly who have been through four wars so far. I mean, the elderly vividly, of course, the youth. The younger kids, of course, some of them, this may be their first experience, keeping in mind that the previous one was 2014. So, you know, anyone born then actually is about 7 years old now, and this is their first experience. So you see the mood swings, you actually see, hear the fear in their voice, the lack of any stability in their lives, the helplessness that they feel, the sort of the more open acknowledgement that if the borders are open, no one should blame us if we decide to pack up and leave a one-way ticket out of Gaza, in a sense, because they have seen so much, in a sense. And every time they are hopeful that this is the last cycle, we're ending this, we're moving on, and thus, you know, Gaza may be on some sort of a trajectory that would see some economic development, some stability, but that, you know, is shattered every few years. So the continued recurrence of these wars every few years, in a sense, each one of them is more devastating regardless of the period of time. Each one creates more destruction. That really, they got to a point that they are extremely tired. And thus, really, you can sense it by just talking to them, listening to their stories, listening to the severe insecurity that they go through, not knowing what will be next during an active war, and even after a war with a very fragile ceasefire at the present time, whether the hostilities will return. So even, you know, if we have supported them with fixing their immediate damages in their homes, you know, how long will that last? Is it just a matter of a few weeks, a few months? When will we have to fix our homes and damages again, and the severity of that situation?
I mean, I've been to Gaza just once, a little over 24 hours, just one night. And it's almost impossible to have a visit to Gaza and not be impacted every step of the way, isn't it? Because from the Erez crossing, you have a long, long way into Gaza. You get handed over from the Palestinian Authority to Hamas. And even getting in feels quite traumatizing. And that's for a Westerner, you know, that isn't particularly restricted beyond those borders, of course. And you think the blockade has been going on since 2007. And even in 24 hours, you get a sense of the life, don't you? Even if it's impossible to fully empathize with what it's like for Gazans on a daily basis. But you hear sort of buzzing in the air, and everything feels slightly threatening and uncertain, doesn't it? So if you're a young child in that environment, I can understand totally what you're saying about the emotional aspect. You yourself experienced, or the delegation experienced on a small level, a shelling, did you not, on the third day of the four-day visit at sort of just past 1 a.m. in the morning. Explain that to us a bit so we can get that sense of how people have to live.
Sure. It was a very scary experience. I mean, this is the first time I felt so close to a shelling. I mean, the shelling was about 200 meters, I was told, away from where we were staying, and it was 1:09 a.m., and a huge blast that, you know, all of a sudden you're jumping out of bed and you're sitting in the middle of the room not knowing exactly what has happened. And then the second shelling takes place a few seconds later and you had just awakened, basically. And the more disturbing part, honestly, wasn't the shaking and, you know, the getting up, but it was the smell of explosives that filled the room, actually, for at least 1 hour. I mean, it was like a dense cloud that filled the room, and all you can smell really is explosives that really, to the point of choking. You know, immediately after the shelling, you know, the sound of the drone sounded like it was in your immediate room. And compound that with the complexity of life in Gaza, that experience was quite terrifying. Having said that, the morning after, and then you don't know what to expect. Is Hamas going to retaliate by sending their own, and then that there will be, you know, a new round? And thank God that didn't happen. So that was a contained one-time shelling. And then the following morning, you're recounting the terrifying experience, actually, to the people around you in Gaza. And basically, they laughed. I mean, not laughed in a sense that they're making a joke out of you, but in a sense, they're recounting their own experience, that this was, you know, such a small sample of what they had experienced, in a sense, that you really, you know, live or feel with them, in a sense. If this was such a terrifying experience, one-time experience, can you imagine what it would have been for them, really having to live through this on a continuous basis for 11 days, day in and day out, and, you know, night and day? And you know, my initial thought, what do I do? Do I pack my things and do I put my clothes on, you know, my pajamas? Do you pack your things? Do you put everything in a suitcase waiting for what next? In a sense, is it safe to stay in this building? And, you know, you live it for a few hours and then it passes. But if you have had to live that life, in a sense, for 11 days this war, 51 days the previous war, and, you know, God knows how many days the previous two wars, in a sense, and then have it recur every few years, you know, with a suitcase packed at the entrance, not knowing, you know, whether you would have to evacuate on short notice, and compound that with the normal things that we take for granted. You know, I take it for granted. My phone is going to be working. The internet should be, you know, ready and able to use, and I'm connected to the outside world, and I can move around freely, and so on and so forth, like any normal human being would experience anywhere else around the world. You take your freedom for granted. You take all these privileges that you have for granted, and all of a sudden, you're there, and none of that applies. So it's just a whole completely different environment you have to live with for a brief period of time. I think the most difficult part for us, really, as we were leaving Gaza, that you have to say goodbye to the people and, in a sense, really know that you're going back to your normal life, and these people are not going back to any normal life, because their normal is not a normal life, in a sense, but has become normal because it has lasted for so long. So for them, you know, going back to a ceasefire situation is a normal life. For me, this is an incredibly difficult life, and for any normal human being, that would be an unbearable life, really.
Now, a quick comment on the Christian community, because obviously it's tiny in Gaza. You've got some 2 million people, maybe 1,000 Christians, of which round about 100, not many at all, Catholics. But I was very impressed when I sat on the virtual Holy Land coordination, that coordination that the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales organises. And it was virtual, naturally, because of the pandemic, yet another backdrop for people in Gaza having to cope with the pandemic as well. But I was very impressed with the way that, you know, the Catholic healthcare was providing for sort of 60% of the population. I mean, our institutions are incredibly strong, aren't they? And they do serve the wider community. It's not just Christian institutions for Christians, and that's all the more obvious in Gaza, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's such a small community, as you rightfully state, about 1,000 Christians, about 140 Catholics or so. Yet the institutional, Christian institutional presence and the Catholic institutional presence makes a huge impact on the life of the general population in Gaza. Keep in mind what the Caritas Medical Center is doing, especially during Corona and the pandemic. And it was unparalleled, you know, with their mobile clinics that were going around and providing services to the population at large. Keep in mind what the Catholic Relief Services operations in Gaza are doing, in a sense, being the only entrusted organization that the American government opened up, if you will, during the difficult Trump years of withdrawing support to the Palestinian people. And they were the only trusted partner of obtaining a major grant from USAID to provide medical services in Gaza and elsewhere, basically heroic work. Look at what our schools are doing. You know, the three Catholic schools, the two Latin Patriarchate schools, the Rosary Sisters School, were the predominantly the beneficiaries of the educational experience with the Christian values at heart. And this is important, critically important to mention, that the education is provided with the Christian values at heart. That goes to approximately 2,500 people, in a sense. Most of them are non-Christian. So the Christians are not necessarily the beneficiaries, the main beneficiaries of the services of our Christian institutions, which are to be considered really the backbone of that Christian presence in Gaza. And yet, we're very happy to do it, and it's visible, and people appreciate it and recognize it, whether it's in health, whether it's in social services, whether it's in education. And on top of that, of course, Yani, I'm proud to say that the most active parish of all of our Latin Patriarchate parishes is our smallest parish, being in Gaza. You go to the parish and every day there are pastoral activities, whether, you know, support activities, spiritual activities, working with the scouts, working with the youth groups, working with the elderly, with the women's groups, and so on and so forth. And thus, you know, the parish with all its activities really keeps the people connected to their faith, keeps them connected to the church, ensures that they are thought about, that they are connected somehow to the outside world through the parish and through these connections as well. So really, I think Gaza, as Christian institutional presence and as the parish work, really is the pride of the Latin Patriarchate. I mean, one of our largest employment program, actually, as part of our humanitarian scheme, is in Gaza. We have 65 people, mostly youth, that are engaged in, you know, very active employment according to their specialization, and they are guaranteed employment for a period of 2 years. It's not only that they're getting a dignified income, but they're gaining experience, something that they can put on their CV for future employment. We're providing training through the Thomas Aquinas Center, basically to upgrade their skills so that they are better employable, in a sense, when the time comes where we say we can no longer support you after 2 years. So the work that is being done in Gaza, really, I think it's wonderful work. But again, under extremely difficult circumstances. So God help us all to be able to continue to provide these you know, services to the wider Gaza community, because the suffering is great, and I think they deserve every support that we're able to do for them.
Now, you've mentioned a lot of Christian institutions there, and it's, you know, it's actually a source of pride to hear how that little parish is punching so far above its weight with very positive people. You know, when I spoke to the parish priest, I was amazed that literally with bombs dropping, his enthusiasm and sort of desire to help was just undiminished in any way. I found it hugely inspiring. And you've talked about a lot of those places that the Patriarch visited, that you all visited during those 4 days. One thing I did want to read back to you in your reflection, because I think it's such an important point, is that, you know, especially in the educational setting, meeting with people that just said, look, let the world know that the people of Gaza are humans and deserve to be treated as such, and seek to live a normal life away from violence. And that really, that touched me as well. I mean, you know, it's a point that needs to be made. But I think that leads us to those underlying causes, Sammy, because you mentioned yourself that, you know, 11 days, 51 days. I mean, when is the next bout of violence coming? When do they have to endure this again? What do you see as the underlying causes? And, you know, without being prophetic, because it's so difficult, how can we walk towards a solution, a peaceful solution?
As far as Gaza is concerned, I think this blockade that has been going on, really creating a, you know, the largest open air prison, if you will, in Gaza, where everything that goes in and out is tightly controlled, whether, you know, goods, services, even people. This prison life condition must end. I mean, the blockade must end. We all recognize that Israel has concerns about its own security. And I think rightfully so, we are concerned about everyone's security in a sense. So the blockade has to end. There has to be some economic development that starts, some rebuilding that is permanent in a sense, some job creation programs in Gaza that are permanent in a sense, that people know that this is here to stay. And number one really is to end that blockade and move on. And the second tier really is to ensure that the Palestinian problem is addressed. You can't have a conflict that continues to simmer for so long and no one is talking anymore about the permanent solution. You cannot just continue to shove it aside and create facts on the ground that would sort of preempt a two-state solution that must be the ultimate goal. If it's not a two-state solution, then it's the one-state solution that is really the solution for the future. And if that is a one-state solution, will it be a state that represents all its citizens and provides equal rights for all its citizens? Is that acceptable to all sides? Whatever the final solution looks like or may look like, we have to start moving in that direction. And thus, just to continue to put the political solution on hold indefinitely and creating further facts on the ground that would make it a dream practically is not the way to go for the future. The Palestinians will be here to stay. The Israelis are here to stay. No one, I think, at this stage is looking to sort of get rid of the other party. And thus, any prolonging of a just solution that would take care of all the issues for the future. And that should be everyone's goal, I think, whether it's, you know, the new administration in the United States, whether the new Israeli government in Israel, there has to be a new vision that this issue cannot continue indefinitely and that there has to be a just solution for the future. And whatever international support that can be provided to move in that direction and end this conflict once and for all, I think is an obligation for everyone that loves the Holy Land, that loves the uniqueness of the Holy Land, loves the city of Jerusalem as a city that should be open for all religions, basically, and for the whole world. I mean, we need to aspire for a better future for us and more so for our children on both sides. And unless we really start to take drastic steps that would lead to that solution, then I'm afraid we're just going from one cycle to the next. So whatever the international community can do, whatever the local politicians can do really to advance in that direction, I think would have to be the way to go. The core issues have to be dealt with so that this, hopefully, what we have seen is the last round of violence and then we move on into a more peaceful world that we all deserve.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And obviously, you know, our lead bishop for international affairs, Bishop Declan Lang, who also chairs the Holy Land Coordination, he's raised this publicly with the UK government. I think it does have to be an international effort, as you say, and leaders come and go, don't they? And yet it's the poor civilians sitting in the middle of all this that end up being the pawns in the game. And it's very disheartening, isn't it? Because obviously we've been coming to the Holy Land year after year after year, standing in solidarity with those Christians and the wider community, of course, because that's our Christian calling too. But it just seems bleak, doesn't it? But that said, give us a little bit of a sense of how the Patriarch felt returning from his four-day visit. Because, you know, that reading your reflection, there were those moments of light, those moments of resilience, those moments of helping the wider community. It's not all bleak, is it? The human spirit flourishes.
Absolutely. And I think he tried to inject a very positive attitude. I think people appreciated his presence for 4 days. I don't think anyone really has done that in recent history, not even, you know, diplomats or UN or whatever. So it was truly very much appreciated that he took the time to spend 4 days with the people there, and he practically visited with everyone and encouraged and supported and injected that spiritual spirit. I mean, you know, the teachings were very clear during that week, you know, to love thy enemy and to try to exercise it in a place like Gaza. How exactly can you do that, in a sense? How can you forgive and move on? But yet he insisted, really, that if we want to move on, we have to really be close to our faith. We have to be close to those teachings, and we have to believe that we're not forgotten, that the people of Gaza should not feel that they are forgotten, and that despite all the difficulties, that there will be a bright future for them once we move on from these cycles of violence. So it was very much appreciated, really, as a spiritual man, to really concentrate on these areas, particularly because no one else was in the mood to talk in those directions, really. So that spiritual dimension and that final mass that we had in Gaza was just absolutely beautiful. You know, seeing the children, you know, with the first communion, with the confirmations, with the baptism, that was the highlight of our visit there. I mean, there were many highlights, but this was it, basically, the spiritual. The stay close to your faith, live your faith, so that we truly can call ourselves Christians and live that Christian values and the Christian life, in a sense. And the message of hope, do not despair. I mean, hope, pray, the power of prayer was present across all visits that we went to. And thus that message of hope was certainly there. And I hope not only that the people of Gaza appreciated the presence, but, you know, the Christian world appreciated that presence as well, because it's critical, really, of a, you know, the voice of leadership in the Catholic Church locally to be able to also say it. But from his point of view, I could tell immediately upon arrival, really, that the thing that really touched him the most, and that was clear throughout the visit, was the trauma that was evident in the people. He said, you know, the stones can be fixed, buildings can be repaired, but can you really repair the psychological damage that these people are suffering? And I think he was really touched at the severity and the extent of the psychological, I think, issues that people had to deal with. And thus, you know, we had committed before leaving that we will try to provide as much support as we can to engage into psychosocial programs, whether at the schools, whether at the parish, whatever we can, so that we can start at least help people rebuild their lives and stand on their two feet again and move on.
Well, we all need to raise our voices on this for a just and peaceful solution for all, as you say. And of course, we appreciate the Patriarch's leadership. I know he will brief the bishops of the Holy Land Coordination, explain to them exactly what's going on. And I pray that we can be back in the region in January, you know, God willing, and Corona under control, I hope, at that point. Just finally, Sammy, I can't let you go without just, you know, as I mentioned a little bit off mic about how we feel quite helpless in the international community, even though it's important we raise our voices. So what can our Catholics in the pew do? They're thinking, you know, it's painful watching the devastation in this holy land. What can they do to offer their support, prayer? What would you say to them?
I think the power of prayer should never be underestimated, honestly. So, you know, the prayers are very much appreciated. The show of solidarity, I think, to the people. Advocacy is quite important. I think, you know, in whatever forum they can advocate for what is just and what is right, I think for our region has to be done at various levels, depending on their networks, depending on, you know, their connections and so on. And whatever material support that they are willing to provide for the people of Gaza, I think, you know, everything I mentioned, whether, you know, we were engaged in humanitarian support and medical support for the elderly, whether we were engaged in, you know, fixing the damages of the homes that were damaged, whether it's psychosocial programs, whether it's scholarship support for the community that can no longer afford to pay their tuition fees. So, that, you know, there's a variety of areas that financially those with the means that would like to contribute to Gaza, I think that would be very much appreciated. But more importantly than the material support, I think it's the solidarity, it's the advocacy, and it's the prayer. And I hope people will be able to exercise whatever is within their means in those areas.
Well, obviously, our prayers are with the people, and they're with you as well, and the Latin Patriarchate. Thank you for your excellent work, and thank you for giving us your time and explaining what's going on the ground. We very much appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sammy.